Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In the wake of the norm-shattering actions of the Trump presidency, as well as the reactions to the Black Lives Matter and Me Too movements, many have been asking the question, how did we get here? In fact, political writer Jared Yates Sexton said he was asked that question a lot after the publication of his book, The People Are Going to Rise Like the Waters Upon Your Shore, which followed the candidacy of Donald Trump back in 2016. Sexton said that while most observers look back to the last 40 to 50 years to answer that question, he decided to reread and try to better understand the long arc of U.S. history, our foundational understanding. And in the spirit of Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States, Sexton's latest book, American Rule, How a Nation Conquered the World But Failed Its People, examines how the reality of the state has failed the lofty rhetoric of our founders and leaders from its very beginnings. Jared Yates Sexton has also written on toxic masculinity and The Man They Wanted Me to Be, and has written for The New York Times, The New Republic, Politico, and Salon.com. He's also written three collections of fiction and is an associate professor of creative writing at Georgia Southern University. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa to talk about his new book, American Rule. Jared, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your latest book, American Rule, is a re-examination of American history going all the way back to the Revolutionary era forward. Tell us the story about how this book came about.
Yeah, I was covering the Donald Trump campaign in 2016. And like a lot of people, I think I expected, for whatever reason, for Donald Trump, who, you know, was a problematic, troubling candidate, to be rejected and that no sane country could possibly elect him president. And when he was elected, I could start to explain it based upon politics going back to the 1960s, 1970s. But, you know, I had a reader who asked me one day, how did we even get to the 60s and 70s? And I realized that my understanding of American history needed something more. So I decided to go back to the very beginning of American history and start to understand how we had arrived to the current moment. And what I found almost immediately was that American history didn't look anything like what I thought it looked like or like I had been taught in school and in my education. And almost immediately, every preconceived notion I had about America was completely thrown out of the window.
How do we get here? What the reader asked you. How did we get here now? And it's a common question many people are asking. But how important is it to go all the way back to the country's founding to understand what's been happening? And I think, like you, I tried to explain it in the last 50 years or so. But why is it important to go back to founding?
Well, I think it's really telling that, you know, Donald Trump, as of recently, has been lashing out against books like mine and projects like the 1619 Project and calling for a patriotic education, which is nothing less than, you know, almost a brainwashing or a strengthening of this mythology that we're talking about. You know, we've been dealing with, these Black Lives Matter protests that are tearing down Confederate statues. And meanwhile, people are saying, well, where does it stop with Washington, Jefferson, Madison? And we're talking about these figures as if they're above reproach. And the reason why we want to protect those statues and the reasons why we don't want to reconsider American history is because when you start looking at American history closely, what you find is that this system of white supremacist, aristocratic control by the wealthy few was actually intentional from the very beginning of this country and was the entire purpose behind the framing of the Constitution. And you start to realize that throughout our history, these ideas and this control has been perpetuated, which means that we actually do need to address it, which is exactly what people like Donald Trump want to keep us from doing.
I think of America as resembling what is said in the preamble of the Constitution, towards a more perfect union. It certainly wasn't perfect prior to the adoption of the Constitution. It wasn't perfect at the time of the Constitution. It's not perfect today, but it's an inevitable move towards a more perfect union. Why is it important to re-examine those founders' motives at the time they wrote those documents?
You know, we've been having this conversation, more or less for the last 50 years. What is America, and is it perfect, or does it need improved? And one of the things you keep seeing is that people who have a vested interest in America staying the way that it is, that is, that the wealthy and the powerful have control over over resources and politics, those people say constantly, how dare you question America? America is the greatest country on the face of the earth. We're exceptional. And we've even seen a branch of judicial philosophy build up around this, the idea of originalism, which, of course, Amy Coney Barrett has, you know, been steeped in. And we've had people like Scalia who have believed in as well. It's the idea that the way that the country was founded, where this white, slaveholding, wealthy few were the people who deserved to control the country and the way that it was constructed. That is what a lot of people are still trying to maintain to this day. And when you try to criticize it or talk about, like you were saying, a more perfect union, they will tell you it's fine. How dare you critique it? How dare you try and change it? And they try and go back to this mythology that America was founded for liberty, freedom, and equality, which are espoused principles, but they are not the principles by which America has lived.
So before we actually talk a little bit about the book, I mean, are you trained as a historian? Or, I mean, you basically wrote a history of the United States. It reminds me very much of Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States in certain ways. It's much shorter. I will tell readers that. How did you begin to sort of go back to the history? What did you read to create your foundational philosophy?
Well, that's true. And one of the reasons I think that I was able to write this book is because I was not trained as a historian. And in fact, when you actually talk to historians, they understand that the history that takes place in the book American Rule is the accurate portrayal of America. But so many historians who are specialized in a certain period or a certain time are sort of siloed away from, you know, the rest of the population, which is an unfortunate side effect of a lot of our history, is that our experts have been neutralized. So I went back and I had to completely relearn the history of America. I tried to start from the very beginning, you know, with primary documents like James Madison's Notes from the Constitutional Convention. And what I found was a really disturbing account, particularly from Madison, in which the founding fathers among themselves were talking about how common people weren't to be trusted. They shouldn't have anything to do with politics or power, and how the wealthy and the powerful were the ones who should run the government. And when I started finding the history written in those stark terms, and I started going through experts and historians' accounts of how things actually took place, I realized very quickly that as a lay person, the history that I had learned through my education and through my understanding of politics, but also popular culture and the stories that my family told, I started to realize as a layperson that my understanding of American history had no relationship to actual American history.
Since you mentioned Madison, let's begin with Madison. You write that when Madison was among the conveners of the Constitutional Convention that ended up bringing us the Constitution, it really wasn't designed to write a Constitution. It was designed to fix the Articles of Confederation, which had seen real issues in its administration and being able to ruled the states as a cohesive whole. You write that Madison basically said, let's chuck this thing and start over.
and by the way, you know, it sounds absurd, but that's the actual truth of the situation. And I find it funny that you and I have both used the terms constitutional convention so far. It was not a constitutional convention until later on. Actually, what you find is that the framers of the Constitution were set to meet in Philadelphia, where they were authorized to revise the Articles of Confederation, which were failing. Well, James Madison, of course, because these were back in the days where, you know, it took days and days and days to ride on your horse to where you were going, James Madison arrived before everyone else and decided that he was just going to write up a new constitution and a new government and a new machine for the government to work by. And by the time people arrived, he and some of his cohorts said, we're not talking about the Articles of Confederation anymore. We're talking about this Constitution. And what you actually find in Madison's notes is that everybody who arrived said, I am not authorized to do this. This is not what we're supposed to do. And Madison and the people who were with him just said, yeah, we're not, but we're going to. So actually, the weird thing about it is if you listen to, you know, historians and political scientists, they have likened the founding of the country and the writing of the Constitution to a small coup d'etat. And even Madison, in his writings in the Federalist Papers, even admitted that they did not have the right to write the Constitution and that it could be considered a coup. But he said, you know what, it was a good coup, so don't worry about it. Which is really bizarre. And I have to tell you that there are so many things like that that I found while writing this book that I read it and I was like, this cannot be real. And then I consulted the historical record and it's absolutely real. It's just it's mind blowing, really.
Well, let me begin with the beginning section of the book, which does talk about the Constitution, but it also goes back to the Declaration of Independence. He said it really at America's founding, which we believe that document to be, it fell short of its ideals from the very moment that the rest of the founders removed Thomas Jefferson's condemnation of slavery from the document. You know, Jefferson is such a complex figure. He owned slaves. He espoused the universal, you know, human rights of man, although it didn't apply to women, didn't apply to people of color, didn't apply to, you know, all sorts of people, to Native Americans. But nonetheless, his rhetoric was aspirational. But when it came down to write it down in the Declaration of Independence, that was removed. Why is this important?
So this is another thing. When I was being taught in school about the founding of the country, I think like a lot of other people, I just sort of thought the Declaration of Independence was, you know, written on a Monday and the Constitution on a Tuesday, and they just kind of went together. But they're totally divorced from one another and actually contradictory towards one another. And what you find with the Declaration of Independence, the one that we have come to know and some schools make you memorize, you start to find that what we know as the Declaration of Independence is actually the second draft of the Declaration of Independence. And the first declaration, the majority of the condemnation at the end of it, where it's saying the crimes against America that have been perpetrated, the majority of it is spent decrying the idea of slavery, which is extremely rich coming from Jefferson, who of course owned hundreds of human beings and generations of slaves. But from the very beginning, Jefferson was striking a blow that might have led to the abolition of slavery from the very beginning. But Congress sent it back to him and said, absolutely not, this isn't going to work, rewrite it and get rid of any mention of slavery. And then the Constitution, years later, of course, enshrines slavery in the law and the foundation of the country.
My guest today is Jared Yates Sexton. He's a political writer and associate professor of creative writing at Georgia Southern University. He's author of several books, including most recently, The Man They Wanted Me to Be and The People Who Are Going to Rise Like the Waters Upon Your Shore. His latest book is titled American Rule, How a Nation Conquered the World but Failed Its People, and it's published by Dutton. From the beginning of the Founding Fathers, you go through history, you look at the horrible divisions over slavery and the fight to rid the country of slavery, but it was never, ever about equal rights. It was only about the right of one human to own another human.
Yeah, and you know, the Civil War and the Confederacy are really misunderstood. How we got to the Civil War, what happened in the Civil War, and what happened afterwards. And you know, we're given this convenient mythology that the South rose up and then they lost militarily, and then slavery went away and white supremacy went away. And in fact, it was absorbed into our laws and in our culture. And part of the problem is we don't have an actual understanding of that time period. And it's really upsetting because when you look at how we got to the Civil War, it looks a lot like our moment right now. You have a group in the South that feels like it's losing power and it becomes embroiled in one conspiracy theory after another. And the Southerners start to see themselves as different from the rest of the country. And you start seeing these split mythologies, which is what happens before every Civil War and is, again, unfortunately, sort of a situation we see ourselves in now. But also, we like to think that the North was necessarily anti-slavery or, you know, really wanted to abolish slavery. Well, the North had its own white supremacy problem. Abraham Lincoln, who, of course, has been turned into a savior in our history and mythology, said on multiple occasions that he believed in white supremacy and, in fact, tried to give the slaves away so that they would leave the country and leave America as a whites-only country after they were freed. These are not stories that we talk about. This is not the history that we talk about. Instead, we hide behind an easy mythology that slavery was abolished and racism went away. And so as a result, like we were talking about earlier, there's nothing to do. The Union is perfect. It's been made perfect. There are no improvements to be made. And inequality is a myth, and if somebody says that there's racism, they're actually doing it in order to play a race card or to get ahead politically or economically. But the truth is, when you look at our history, you realize it's a lot more sordid than that.
One of the terms you use throughout the book is very interesting. You call it the cult of the shining city. What do you mean by that?
So the cult of the shining city is the label that I have given to white identity neo-Confederate evangelicalism that in the 1980s merged with Ronald Reagan's view of the nation and has gained political power since then. I think it's really important that we separate that type of Christianity away from Christianity in totality, because this is based on the religion of the Confederate States of America, a white supremacist religion that right now is talking about, you know, the apocalypse. It's talking about satanic conspiracies. It's talking about, you know, everything from QAnon to the deep state to what you find when you turn on Fox News of the evening. It is a special brand of Christianity that has taken control of the political structure in America. And quite frankly, it has done a lot of damage.
Actually, the imagery of the shining city goes all the way back to pre-nationhood when the Puritans, that's puritanical thought.
Absolutely. And it's one of the animating mythologies of America. There's always been this very, very small tie between Christianity and our political structure because, you know, we've had that division between church and state. But what you saw with Ronald Reagan is Ronald Reagan literally believed that the Declaration of Independence was saved by an angel who appeared to the founding fathers, and that we were ordained by a Christian God in order to lead the world against the satanically inspired Russian Empire. Well, what happens when you start to believe that? It suddenly makes it to where there's no way to criticize America. There's no way to talk about making a more perfect union because you're actually troubling divinity at that point. And so it creates a cultish atmosphere in which people literally believe that America is infallible and America cannot be improved. And to say otherwise is actually a heresy.
I'm going to go back to another central theme. It's in the subtitle of the book, How a Nation Conquered the World But Failed Its People. You also document a number of situations where people felt betrayed by the United States, going back to Shays' Rebellion, which was actually under the Articles of Confederation. You look at how the Constitution was created, in which it was basically giving the aristocracy of the time the keys to political power. They had the right to vote. It was landed white men that had the initial of right to vote. And you write that it was supposed to work within the government, that this landed aristocracy, or maybe not aristocracy at this point, but the 1% perhaps, were supposed to run the government. Let's fast forward to the Gilded Age. All of a sudden, the 1% is not running the government. They are running the people who run the government. What happens then?
Yeah, and we have to look at the Gilded Age to really understand the moment that we are in. And what ends up happening is that the founders thought that the wealthy and the powerful would be the most invested in the good of America. And what ends up happening, particularly at the turn of the 20th century, is you have a group of robber barons, tycoons, multimillionaires, these monopolies that control the economy, but they're not particularly interested in politics. They're more interested in private business. And so what they end up doing is they start using their wealth and their influence to buy off politicians and to buy off the political structures. It looks a lot like what we have today, which is where the government is actually at the behest of the wealthy and powerful. And as a result, it's not doing the people's business. It's actually a betrayal of the social contract that, you know, representative government is supposed to operate by. But what we see right now is exactly what we saw at the turn of the 20th century, in which, you know, we're primed to be in a position where things like the 40-hour work week, the weekend, even children having the right to go to school instead of having to labor in mines and sweatshops, those things are in trouble because we have seen in the past that when these moneyed and landed interests take over the government starts doing the work of the wealthy few instead of the people that they represent.
Of course, during the Gilded Age, it yielded to the Progressive Age, and it actually began a movement by fits and starts that actually tried not to fail its people. It tried to lift people up. You know, it looked at corruption like the way wealthy robber barons literally bought the Senate, because Senate was chosen by state legislatures and allowed people to directly elect their senators. It broke up trust. It started providing measures of fair food, fair drug acts, work week protections, child labor protections. But something happened, and that was sort of an era that, you know, by fits and starts, there were backlashes to it. But that era sort of progressed till somewhere in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, and I would say this, because we're talking about a lot of complicated, disturbing stuff. We're talking about taking this sort of squeaky clean mythology and sort of dirtying it up in order to talk about what has really happened. And that's a complicated thing. But I will point out that the progressive age that you just brought up is indicative of something that makes me incredibly optimistic, which is that there are these periods of pendulum swinging. And on one side of the pendulum is where Americans feel like they don't have power and that they're without agency and that they're, you know, they're at the whims of a powerful few, including corporations and politicians, and that politics is a spectacle to watch, you know, whether it's in the papers or on TV. But when they remember that they do have control and they do have agency, and through organization and solidarity, they can make massive change, they achieve massive change, which makes me incredibly optimistic. But this current era that we are in, the pendulum has moved the other way. And starting, I would say, in the late 60s, 1970s, and then in the 1980s, politics became a spectacle. It became something for us, again, to watch on TV, to, you know, see heroes and villains and caricatures of politicians. And this is how you end up with a reality TV star as president of the United States, because it's all about entertainment. And unfortunately, that entertainment and that spectacle is also the origin of a lot of profit. Our media is making a ton of money off of Donald Trump and our current moment of political crisis. But once we realize that this isn't good for us and it actually leads to, you know, worse lives, and that we do have agency and we do have power, I think that we can turn the tide on this and push the pendulum in the other direction. But in order to do so, I think we have to move away from these mythologies and these illusions.
You talked a little bit about the mass media in the book, and you says it has conflicting roles. It can expose the brutal treatment of civil rights protesters or Black Lives Matter protesters, the brutality of the Vietnam War or abuses in the Middle East. But it also, you say it also can reinforce these false narratives.
Yeah, and this is a hard thing to understand. But if you actually go back throughout history, what you find is that journalism and media has always been a partisan endeavor. You know, recently in a post-Watergate world, we have reporters who talk a lot about being, you know, unpartisan or being unbiased, but that's actually impossible. And it's especially impossible when the people who control media, whether it's networks or stations or, you know, social media empires, these are people who have their own viewpoint of how the world works and what reality is. And so one of the things that happens is, you know, whether you want to believe that MSNBC is on the left or CNN in the middle or Fox News on the right, what you also need to understand is that the stories that we're getting about America are also filtered through a viewpoint that don't necessarily lead to accurate portrayals of what has happened. And they rely mostly on spectacles. So, for instance, you brought up the Black Lives Matter movement this summer, which gained a lot of coverage in the press. And for sure, these networks had cameras in the streets. They were talking to people. They were showing the protest movement. But the cameras then went away after a week or so while the movement continued. And it gave the country the idea that they had just sort of dried up and weren't active anymore or didn't have a power all of their own. This is a skewing of how reality works. And depending upon how you want to cover the story or give histories, that also changes the way that we perceive the world and the reality that we're living in. And it turns out, and this is something I think that Donald Trump has exposed more than nearly anybody else, it's that there is no such thing as objective reality, something that we all agree on. There's only subjective reality. We all have different versions of how our lives feel and how reality in the world works. And when you start trying to bring those things together, particularly in a media environment the way that we have right now, it becomes very messy and potentially dangerous, which unfortunately we've seen play out over the past few years.
One of the things your book talks about is how Donald Trump's election came about. One of your previous books, The People Are Going to Rise Like the Waters Upon Your Shore, was a more closer examination of that. But what do we need to know in the long arc of American history about the election of Donald Trump?
I think when we look back at this moment, we're going to realize that this was sort of a consequence of a created artificial reality on the part of the American right. Over the past couple of decades, we have seen this strange conspiratorial alternate reality take place. And it started in the late 1980s, early 1990s, with the rise of things like the New World Order conspiracy theory, which the Republican Party used to its advantage, the National Rifle Association used, people like Rush Limbaugh and other pundits who weren't really concerned about consequences of these things. And then, of course, Fox News, which in essence is a conspiracy theory network that broadcasts 24 hours a day towards paranoid viewers. And so we have created this little pocket universe or alternate reality in which Donald Trump is the personification of those paranoid conspiracy theories that literally has nothing to do with the realities that most Americans, roughly 60% of Americans, don't even recognize and don't live within. So I think we're going to see this as a strange aberration and a side effect of a major media conglomerate.
You know, when you talk about your subtitle again about the nation failing its people, I think this is not one party that just failed the people. It's been both parties. I mean, when we were talking about the digital revolution, Democrats were talking about taking steel workers and auto workers and manufacturing that was leaving the shores and saying, "Ah, you're going to be a computer programmer." I mean, this massive retraining for people in which, you know, the people said, "I'm not going to be able to do that," and I'm not. You know, I mean, there's a little bit of both siders in the idea that both parties have failed people without power and money.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. I'm actually from a family of factory workers, laborers, miners, and to tell them that their jobs are going to change, it also messes with their own reality and their own versions of who they think they are. It messes with their identities. So that didn't go over well. But you also have with the Democratic Party, they decided in the early 1990s to move right and embrace Reaganism and turn their back on a lot of those labor unions and a lot of the people of color that, you know, they now appeal to. So this entire structure that moved away from representing people definitely has a responsibility on both sides. But what we see with the Republican Party right now is a particularly aggressive and dangerous movement.
Well, at the very end of your book, you offer a couple of quick prescriptions. What are those prescriptions?
I think we need to remember that we have power and that through organization and solidarity, we can enact massive amounts of change. But we also need to actively turn our backs on this culture of division and on this culture of spectacle. We have to do better. We have to, I always put it into a three-part idea. We need to get educated, we need to get angry, and we need to get organized.
Organization works in short spurts. Do you think the American people can stay organized and stay vigilant? I mean, this is one of the things that's been a recurrence in American history. American people will seize a moment, make a change, or not make a change, but then they become disengaged.
I certainly hope that we can become active and stay active. I think seeing Donald Trump, and particularly what he's been capable of, I think that we are starting to gain an idea of what the consequences are of not being engaged and not being active in the fight. So I do have hope, and I am optimistic that maybe we can make a permanent change.
Jared, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Political writer Jared Yates Sexton speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book is titled American Rule, How a Nation Conquered the World but Failed Its People. It's published by Dutton. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.